It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin animal shelters are reporting a growing number of pet surrenders. Many are struggling to keep up. According to a report from WPR's Evan Casey, it's due in part to the rising cost of owning a pet. A 2025 report from the Bank of America Institute found that the cost of pet services, things like vet bills, has risen by 42% since 2019. The price of pet food and treats also up 22%. At the same time, some shelters are facing their own financial challenges and staffing and capacity crunches as they deal with that jump in animals coming through their doors. We're checking in with two of Wisconsin's biggest humane societies to talk about what they need from their communities to get some relief. Amy Good is Director of Development and Marketing at the Dane County Humane Society. Amy, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
And Allison Foch is President and CEO of the Wisconsin Humane Society, which operates shelters in Milwaukee, Ozaukee, Racine, Kenosha, Door, and Brown counties. Allison, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Allison, let's start with you. Can you paint us a picture of what you're seeing this year when it comes to the demand for your services for pets coming into the society?
Yeah, we are definitely seeing an uptick in owner surrenders coming into our shelter. Just last year, we served about 4,200 animals through owner surrender by this time in the year, and we're up by over 1,000 animals coming through owner surrender. And part of that was a system shift that we made by no longer asking for appointments for surrender, and the community really needed that from us, and we are seeing them bring those animals in. And so we are definitely seeing a peak in our animal population, which is also pretty typical of this time of year. So we are definitely experiencing that capacity crisis and space crunch with those uptick of animals.
And Amy, what are you seeing at the Dane County Humane Society?
So we've seen a slight uptick in owner surrenders, but our biggest crunch right now is the number of animals that have been impounded in our community. And those are animals that have been brought to us by animal service officers or other law enforcement. And those animals we're holding on to for a long time as they go through court cases.
And that people may not know this. Some humane societies have this, I think, contract with cities or counties. Can you talk about that part of your services?
Right. So we contract locally with Public Health Madison-Dane County to provide services for stray animals, as well as impounded animals. And that could mean all sorts of different things walking through our doors on an emergent basis or animals that we know are going to be with us for 3 months or more.
I want to ask about the why of the increase. Allison, you mentioned that change in the appointment system, but we're hearing not just around Wisconsin, around the country, more people having to give up their pets. Why are we seeing this happen? Or at least why are you seeing that happen in the communities you serve?
We are definitely seeing systemic issues facing our community that are driving these separations of families. So the biggest factor for us has been housing, just housing instability, lack of pet inclusive and affordable housing for the communities that we serve, coupled with the cost of care, as was mentioned earlier. Cost of having an animal is just continues to increase. And then there is a national veterinary shortage, which makes access to veterinary care not only harder to gain, but it's also more expensive. And so all of those factors, those system issues, are really driving those separations and driving people to make really challenging decisions for their families.
And Amy, you mentioned some more surrenders, not the jump that some communities are seeing, but more stray and impounded animals. Do we know what's making that go up lately?
We're not really sure why this year is just really unprecedented levels of impounds, especially for our community. But it's certainly taking a toll on our staff.
Now, if people who own pets are having to pay more for pet food and veterinary services, I'm guessing humane societies are facing the same challenges. Amy, let's start with you this time. The cost side of things, what are you seeing?
Right. So everything has gone up when it relates to animals, and our food costs have gone through the roof, but just all those veterinary supplies as well. Everything that owners are facing, the shelters are seeing, but multiply that times, 200-300 animals at a time.
And in Dane County, is that putting you in a difficult financial situation between those costs and that stray and impounded animal issue you mentioned?
Absolutely. For us, our funding gap this year between what we're getting for the contract and what we're anticipating will actually cost us to provide those services is over $1 million. So it's really a huge challenge and a huge gap to try to make up.
And Allison, in the humane societies you work with the shelters you work with, are you seeing similar funding challenges?
We're in a strong financial position, thanks to a lot of community support. However, as Amy mentioned, we are experiencing those increased costs. I mean, we have over 1,400 animals in our care as of today, and the cost of food, the cost of veterinary care, the cost of hard goods to care for animals, the cost to support our staff, a living wage, all of those things impact our financial position as well. Well,
and Allison, more animals means more space needs, more labor needs, more people to deal with those animals. Are you at or beyond capacity right now?
We are at a critical capacity at this point. We have lots of adoption promotions. We have over 500 animals available for adoption today and an additional 100 who could move out to foster homes. So we are definitely at a point where that's critical for us, and we are looking for adopters, foster homes, volunteers, et cetera, to help us get those animals into homes.
And Amy, what are you seeing when it comes to capacity?
So very similar to what Allison is seeing in all of her shelters as well. Spring and summer is always a really busy time. We start to see a lot more baby animals coming in. So kitten season is what we talk about a lot, too. So we are to the point also of adoption specials, hoping our community comes in and really helps us, you know, find more homes for the pets and already in our care.
We are talking with Amy Good with the Dane County Humane Society and Allison Fotch with the Wisconsin Humane Society, which serves a number of counties around the state, talking about some of the challenges facing humane societies, a lot of demand for their services, costs, and more. Well, when we talk about taking care of animals, a lot of people will be listening thinking, what can I do to help? Allison, let's start with you. What kind of things can people in the communities you serve do to help out?
I mean, right now, looking for folks to come into any number of our shelters. If they're looking to add a pet to their family, adoption is a fantastic option. If you're not in a position to make that permanent jump right now, fostering is a great option too. It's also allows you to do a little bit of a trial if that ends up being a match for your family. Donations also are hugely important. Our summer match is launching tomorrow, and donations will be tripled to that campaign. And that just helps us keep ongoing operations to support the thousands of animals we serve annually.
And Amy, what are your priorities when you reach out to the community in Dane County?
Very similar. So obviously we need adopters as well. And donations are just so critical to our work. We are definitely community supported and need that. And for us, uniquely in our community right now, it's the advocacy that we're going to need to make sure that we have a contract with our government that's actually more equitable and is actually going to help us pay for the actual cost for our animals.
One particular issue I've been hearing about, Amy, Allison mentioned housing. Right. Mm-hmm. Not all landlords will allow pets, or they might limit it to cats or smaller dogs. I'm hearing that there's a particular concern about people with larger dogs, over 50 pounds, say, is often the limit. What is happening in Dane County when it comes to that? And are you looking for people to adopt those larger dogs in particular?
We definitely see big dogs lasting longer in the shelter. Their stays with us are longer just because of all those definite barriers to homes, and especially certain breeds that are restricted. They can't go to certain apartment complexes either, or people have homeowners insurance that doesn't allow certain breeds. So our larger dogs, especially bully breeds, are sitting longer at our shelter.
Same story, Allison, in your shelters.
Absolutely. Those medium to large breed dogs tend to sit longer in the shelter, and which is unfortunate. They're great dogs, but those housing restrictions are limiting.
Are there resources out there for people who can't afford things like vet bills or pet food, but really don't want to have to give up their pet? Allison, let's start with you in the counties you're working in.
Sure. One of the exciting parts about kind of dismantling our intake by appointment system was we did shift a position to become a community resource navigator. And so that person's job is to connect with families who are interested in exploring resources to support keeping that family together. And whether that's a resource we can provide, or the staff member is connecting with other human service organizations in the community to ensure that if a family experiencing human side of the leash, if you will, issues, has the resources that they need in order to keep that family together.
Amy, do you have similar services in Dane County?
Right. Anytime we can prevent an animal from needing to separate from their family, we're going to try to keep that family together. We know how important that bond is between people and their pets. So we certainly have services as well if people need help with pet food, if it's access to vet care, or other things that we can do to help that relationship stay intact, we're going to do it.
Looking to the future, we've got some acute problems now. Long term, I want to ask each of you, are there things we can do to lower the demand for the service you provide and for the need to people to surrender their pets? Allison, let's start with you. What would you point to as a longer term solution?
Obviously housing, that's a huge issue, and that's a very knotty issue. More acutely, I think the access to spay-neuter services, we're one of the largest providers in the state for low-cost spay-neuter services, and that certainly has a direct impact, as has been the case for decades, in lowering shelter intake. And so making those veterinary services more affordable is the goal.
And Amy, magic wand for you, what would be one thing that would help in the long run?
I'm with Allison on this. Spay and neuter is the way to go. And that is, you know, we're spaying and neutering everything leaving our shelter, but also we need higher levels of it in the community. But access is always going to be one of the biggest challenges. But preventing those litters from being born goes a long way.
And Amy, let's talk to those people around the state who maybe are dragging their feet on spaying and neutering. Talk directly to them.
Sure. So even if you can find homes for all the animals that you are raising at your house, that means somebody is not coming to a shelter to adopt one of our animals. And we know there's already more animals right now sitting in shelters than we're able to find homes for. So help us be part of the solution and reach out if you need help.
And we'll leave it there. Amy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Allison, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Allison Foch is president and CEO of the Wisconsin Humane Society, which operates shelters in Milwaukee, Ozaukee, Racine, Kenosha, Door, and Brown counties. Amy Good is director of development and marketing at the Dane County Humane Society. We've been talking about some of the challenges animal shelters are facing around Wisconsin. Coming up, new research on the Menominee River on the Michigan-Wisconsin border finds a lot of farming in pre-contact cultures.
As archaeologists, we've grossly underestimated the scale of ancestral Native American farming in North America.
Find out why the discovery is shaking up archaeology. That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. Along the Menominee River, on the border between Wisconsin and Michigan's Upper Peninsula, archaeologists have discovered what they believe to be the largest intact remains of an ancient Native American agricultural site in the eastern U.S. dating back 1,000 years. Using drones and LIDAR technology to look at raised gardening beds along a stretch of the river, a team of researchers from Dartmouth College found that the ancestors of the Menominee Indian tribe of Wisconsin were growing crops at a much, much larger scale than previously thought. David Greenone is the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer with the Menominee Indian Tribe of Wisconsin. He worked with Dartmouth researchers on the new report. And Madeline McLeister is an assistant professor in the Department of Anthropology at Dartmouth College. She co-authored the new report on the findings in the journal Science. Madeline, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me.
And David, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
So, David, let's start off by looking at the site. This was pretty significant and important even before this new research we're talking about. Can you tell us a little bit about this 60-island region and what it means?
Well, the Menominee people had lived on the Menominee River for thousands of years. Our creation story took place at the mouth of the Menominee River, and we have several occupation sites up and down the Menominee River, burial sites, mounds, sacred areas, ceremonial areas. But the 60 islands area is pretty significant to us because it was said that one of our people had a dream about 60 islands, that this area was contained a good place to live, hunting area, fishing area, wild rice area. So a group of our people had moved up there and lived there for thousands of years using the site.
Now, Madeline, when you and your team came to look at this area, what first made you want to start looking for signs of more, I think, more agriculture than we might have expected beforehand?
We had been collaborating with Dave Greeno, as well as an archaeologist, Dave Overstreet, who recently passed, on identifying and mapping agricultural field ridges at the Menominee Reservation. And alongside that work, Dave Greeno and Dave Overstreet had been trying to get the 60 islands and surrounding area listed on the National Register of Historic Places, which they succeeded in doing. And that area is called Ana M. Omet, though you can get a better pronunciation of it from Dave. And so we had been testing, you know, using drone LiDAR to map these features. And 60 Islands was identified in the early 90s by archaeologists and mapped by a woman named Marla Buckmaster. And along with Jan Brashler, they excavated portions of it. And Buckmaster thought she had mapped about 60% of the site. And so Dave Greeno and Dave Overstreet were really interested in getting a full account of the site. And LiDAR mapping is very good at that. So we came out and we did it. And what we found was not only was the site much more extensive, so much larger than what was previously mapped. So it's we found about 95 hectares in cultivation, so 10 times bigger than what Buckmaster had mapped previously, that it was denser, so much, there are many more ridges, and then also that it extended beyond the survey area. So there's huge portions of the site potentially that are still not yet known.
David, when this LiDAR information came back, what did you think of that? I assume you suspected that there was more than met the eye here. But when we saw Madeline's team come back with this data, what did you think about that?
Well, I thought it was amazing because we only by looking at the site, we only saw parts of the garden beds, but the LiDAR discovered more extensively sites of garden beds, different archaeological features.
Madeline, this is interesting locally, of course, and for the history of the Menominee people here, of course, but it's also a big deal in capital letters, as I understand it, for North American archaeology. Period. What is the significance? Why are we getting even national attention on this?
Well, it's not just significant nationally, but we'll cover why that's significant. But it's also globally important, I think, for thinking through some kind of central tenets of archaeological theory. So I'll start with why it's significant in North American archaeology. So 60 Islands, even at 9.5 hectares, was one of the largest, if not the largest, preserved ancestral Native American agricultural site in Eastern North America. And the reason for that is that these features are very subtle. They have a very low relief between, they're about a foot high. But, and the second those areas are plowed, or you put a parking lot on it or any other type of development, they are gone. And so if you think about, like, where are you putting these features? You're putting them on good farmland. And so a lot of these features, you know, Euro-Americans came in settled this area, and they all of them got plowed over. And we actually see in the late 1800s, or kind of early archaeologists lamenting the fact that these features are disappearing. So in the 1800s, we're not documenting them. So now they're just, they would have been the most common archaeological feature, and now they are among the rarest. So what's significant here is that if this area, you would not expect to have such extensive agriculture because it's difficult to grow the crops that are kind of the plants that grow on these beds, corn, beans, and squash. It's difficult to grow them this far north. And it would have been even colder in the past because of the Little Ice Age. But these ancestral Menominee farmers are able to figure it out, obviously, and they're able to modify the landscape just at a huge scale. So if they're doing that in this place where it's hard to farm, where everything we know about these ancestral communities is that they're relatively smaller, and yet we see this level of landscape reworking, that means that we've, as archaeologists, we've grossly underestimated the scale of ancestral Native American farming in North America. And so that means, think of places like Cahokia, where it is a giant community, right? The other thing to think about is that as archaeologists globally, when we think about why communities undertake intensive agriculture, it's typically because of things like population pressure, increasing hierarchies, neither of which we know of in the past for ancestral Menominee communities. So that kind of casts, again, this global importance of the site to show that you don't need steep hierarchical structures. You don't need steep inequality to have intensive agriculture. That there's other ways that these systems come into being.
Madeline, as I'm reading about this, is a lot of what we're talking about is happening at the same time as the height of Cahokia down by what's now St. Louis. I know we had Cahokian outposts here in Wisconsin. Are we seeing evidence, or are there indications that the Menominee people we're talking about here are interacting with those fringes of Cahokian culture?
So that's a great question. I would say what I actually expect is if they are trading some of this corn or bringing it anywhere, so you're still pretty far from those Cahokia or from those Mississippi and Cahokian outposts, those northernmost ones here in Wisconsin. My hunch would be that if they are trading it, they probably are moving it north, where it is. You know, they're at the very kind of northern limits of where corn, beans, and squash grow. And so it's likely instead that they're moving, they're trading with folks for farther north for, I don't know what they're trading for, but that would be my guess.
We found out that one of our archaeological sites near Menominee, on the Menominee River, included obsidian. And obsidian must have been traded to the Menominees. For what reason or for what, I don't know. So there must have been extensive trading going on.
We are talking about this archaeological research on the Wisconsin-Michigan border along the Menominee River, an amazing chapter in the history of archaeology and the Menominee people in the area. Madeline McLeister is with us, professor at Dartmouth College in the Anthropology Department, and David Greenone, Tribal Historic Preservation Officer with the Menominee Indian Tribe of Wisconsin. David, I want to talk about the cooperation here, because I know the history of archaeology and tribal groups has not always been happy, but you've worked with David Overstreet and now with Madeline and her team. Can you talk about the cooperation and how that's worked here?
Well, we worked with Dr. David Overstreet for about 30 years here on the reservation. He was a contract archaeologist for us, and we, not only here, but in the extended territory of our tribe, including the Menominee River. And we, the relationship between the archaeologists and the tribe is really good. And it still is today. Sorry that our archaeologist, Dr. David Overstreet, just passed away, but it's ongoing with Madeline doing the work at 60 Islands, and hopefully she can identify more sites up there to help solidify our existence on the Menominee River.
Madeline, I want to talk about how you're doing that research. There's some of what we might think of as traditional archaeology going on, but you also mentioned this LIDAR, and a lot of these remote sensing from up in the air technologies, it seems like, are changing archaeology, not just on the Menominee River, but all over the world, and leading to discoveries that we had no idea were there. Can we talk about that technology and how it's being harnessed?
Sure. So what LIDAR does is it essentially sends lasers down through to the surface, and then those lasers hit the ground and they come back up. So that creates a topographic map of the Earth's surface. And what's exciting about LIDAR is that it can, to a certain extent, it can penetrate the tree canopy. In a place like 60 Islands, where the tree canopy is so dense, we actually flew the LIDAR in this really tight window where the snow has melted, but the leaves haven't emerged on the trees. Typically, LIDAR has been flown from an airplane. And of course, you have to fly an airplane fairly high in the sky, whereas a drone can fly much lower. So that allows us to get a higher resolution for these low relief features. So when we think about some of the early LIDAR discoveries, those were, those are building foundations, things like that. But now with the drone LIDAR, and this is some of the earliest data with drone LIDAR, this has only been around for the decade, really. And it keeps getting better, which is exciting. But with the drone LIDAR, you can fly that drone lower. And so things that have just that, foot relief can actually show up. You can just cover a huge area, have it mapped relatively quickly. We were also able to find other features. So, for instance, there's a burial mound group that was thought to be completely destroyed, but there's still some burial mounds remaining, which is exciting. There's also we found a dance ring. And so these kinds of things just show how integrated and complex the landscape was.
David, this makes me think about the people. And now you're there, and as part of this effort, you're identifying, hey, this is where people maybe 1,000 years ago were dancing in this dance ring, or they had their hands in the soil planting squash and corn and beans. What do you think about as you think about the people who left this evidence, these mounds, these rings behind?
They're our ancestors, and we continue to have gardens. Not extensively as our ancestors did, but we continue to do that. We continue our ceremonies here on the Menominee Reservation, much like our ancestors did on the Menominee River.
I want to ask each of you about your future hopes for research at this amazing place. David, let's start with you this time. This isn't the end of the story, I don't think. What are you still hoping to learn and to find here?
I'm hoping that more features like mounds and ceremonial areas, burial grounds will be found so that we can preserve them as much as we can for the Menominee tribe.
And Madeline, your hopes to find more here when, as you said, there might be similar sites over the country that are under farm fields or parking lots now. What are your hopes for future research here?
So I think you know, I think with this new technology that we're going to find more and more of these agricultural sites across North America in places where we haven't looked, in unlikely places. At the site in particular, I'm really interested in how farming this far north, was this successful? What kinds of soil amendments and what are people adding to the soil to make the crops grow so successfully this far north? I'm very interested in that question, kind of how the ancestral Menominee communities did it. I'm also wondering, where is the village, right? So we have just a tremendous, extensive agricultural features that could feed a lot of people. And so I'm very curious where they were all living. And so that's actually, we're up here now looking for that.
And we'll leave it there. David, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Madeline, thanks for sharing your work with us.
Thank you.
Madeline McLeister is an assistant professor in the Department of Anthropology at Dartmouth College. Her team recently uncovered the largest intact remains of an ancient Native American agricultural site in the eastern U.S. It's along the Menominee River on the Wisconsin-Michigan border. And David Greenone is tribal historic preservation officer with the Menominee Indian Tribe of Wisconsin. He's been working with Dartmouth researchers for decades on this site. Had a new horror novel is set in the north woods of Wisconsin. What's on the loose? Not scorpions or crabs or spiders. They've been done before. Cue the giant ticks.
They're gross. They're disgusting. They're pretty horrendous creatures, and they're responsible for a lot of disease and death.
The author of Tick Town is on Wisconsin Today. You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Bridget Bowden with a story about surfing in Wisconsin. It's part of WPR's Wisconsin Road Trip series, which features pit stops across the state to explore some of the people, places, and things that make Wisconsin summers special.
Sheboygan brands itself as Wisconsin's Malibu of the Midwest for its popular freshwater surfing scene on Lake Michigan. Surfing is a year-round sport in the community, and WPR's Joe Schultz decided to try it himself.
Waves crash into the beach at Deland Park in Sheboygan as Andrew Jacobs gives a surfing lesson.
My goal for any surf lesson is that by the end of our time, you are going to paddle in, pop up, and ride your first wave. That is our goal. Not everybody gets that goal, so don't get discouraged by it.
The person he's talking to is me. Sheboygan is the surfing capital of Wisconsin, and my editors forced me to try it myself. No spoilers, but it's not easy. We'll get back to that in a bit. Andrew owns EO Surf Shop in Sheboygan with his wife, Hannah. Before the lesson, they led a tour of the shop.
We kind of made the front of the shop, when you come through the door, really focused on those items that are for everybody, right? So that's going to be your hats, your clothing, your sweatshirts, your sandals.
Toward the back of the shop, surfboards are displayed along the wall to the left. Skateboards are to the right. The couple took over as owners of the shop in late 2022. But Sheboygan surf culture has a history that stretches back decades. Just ask Andrew.
It's recorded back. People were surfing Lake Michigan back to the early 50s.
Sheboygan surfers began forming clubs by the 60s, and the community hosted an annual surfing competition from the late 80s through the early 2010s. Andrew and Hannah say they took over the shop a few years back to use it to help foster a sense of community. They've done so through youth skate camps, free community paddle events, and a thrift shop in the store's basement. Hannah says community events provide a space for people to connect and build relationships.
So that you do have a buddy, so you can get on that text thread of like five or six people that are like, hey, we're going out at this time, who's showing up?
Surfing is a year-round sport in Sheboygan. Andrew says one of the best times for it is actually in the middle of winter. The winter means bigger waves.
We're out there surfing in the blizzards and in the snowstorms and everything else. So this last year, the longest window I went without being in Lake Michigan was just shy of 2 weeks.
At the Jacobs' recently opened snack shack and rental location at Deland Park, it was warm and sunny as waves crashed on the beach.
We're looking at a very, very light north wind that's coming through.
That's where they gave me my first surfing lesson. I'm not exactly the most coordinated guy. I've skateboarded a little, but I always had to work very hard to be just average. Needless to say, I was a little daunted by the prospect of trying to stand up on a surfboard. And let me tell you, getting into a wetsuit isn't quite as easy as it sounds.
I got my feet through the bottom, and then I'm like pulling it up, and I'm like trying to stick an arm in, and I'm like, oh, the crotch is at my knees.
Soon after, Andrew walked me through the basics of where to place my feet on the board and how to stand up. He gave me a little bit of time to practice on the beach.
Paddle, paddle, put your arms underneath you. Give space, push your chest up. Now pull your back foot in front.
Then we headed into the water. On my first few attempts, I fell almost immediately. After a few more unsuccessful tries, I balanced myself on the board for all of 3 seconds before I fell back in. That's about the best I did the whole day. Like Andrew says, surfing is hard. I swallowed at least a couple mouthfuls of lake water when I wiped out. But it's also rewarding. My producer captured my reaction when I got back to the beach.
It's way harder than it looks. The surfer bros make it look like you just kind of like ride it out and you're... It's... And I'm out of shape, the desk job, you know. But it's fun. And thank God it's not salt water.
Andrew was a patient teacher who knows how to push you outside your comfort zone. I'm glad I did it, but I'm not so sure I'll be joining him when he goes out in the next Wisconsin blizzard.
WPR's Joe Schultz brought us that story on surfing in Sheboygan. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Bridget Bowden.
Join us every Friday this summer for more Wisconsin road trips. To see all the stops and plan your own road trip, find the series page at wpr.org/roadtrip. Okay, imagine the scene. A band of giant, mutant, monster-sized ticks have infiltrated a small Northwoods, Wisconsin tourist town. And two reporters at the fledgling local newspaper have to get to the bottom of the carnage. That's the setup of a debut horror novel from Fond du Lac native Christopher Miklos. He's a filmmaker, writer, and self-proclaimed lifelong horror junkie. His novel is called Tick Town. He talked to Kate Archer Kent about his pulp horror adventure.
This book is about a giant creature, or creatures, in northern Wisconsin. Why ticks?
Well, that's a great question. I'd set out to write something in the creature feature genre for my first novel, and I was very much inspired by a late 70s pulp horror paperback called Night of the Crabs, about giant crabs run amok in the Welsh countryside. But crabs had been done so often, and spiders had been done for so often, and scorpions and all that. I wanted to do something that was more relevant to Wisconsin. And what's more relevant to Wisconsin than ticks?
Ticks are scary.
Ticks are gross. They're disgusting. They're pretty horrendous creatures, and they're actually... They're responsible for a lot of disease and death, and they're one of the biggest killers in the state, actually. So it was a good I thought it was a good subject that would be very ripe for horror.
Ripe for horror, because what makes them scary is that they are so small and can go undetected for so long. I mean, what are the added horrors of you like scaling them up to be much, much bigger than humans?
Well, if you actually ever look at a tick close up, and I looked at a lot of images of ticks close up, they're pretty horrendously frightening creatures with their mouth parts are jagged and choppy, and they, you know, have got the long sucker that comes out and stabs into you, and the way they eat, it's all pretty grotesque. So yeah, I agree with you completely that they're pretty horrifying at the tiny level. But I think if I ever saw one that was the size of an ottoman or the bigger queen tick that shows up later in the book, I would be pretty horrified, I think.
Take us to Tomahawk Hollow when they're about to have this big Jubilee festival showing off the town. What is this little town like?
Well, I think it's a town that we would very much recognize here in Wisconsin, in rural Wisconsin. It's, you know, everyone knows everyone's name. There are very few surprises. A lot of the town is built on, you know, it's nestled in the woods and it's built on tourist trade. And every year they have the Harvest Moon Jubilee that they depend on for their economic survival. They've got a small town mayor who's, you know, not that you find corrupt mayors in Wisconsin, but, you know, there's definitely some jaws in the DNA of Ticktown. And so, you know, I want a corrupt mayor who is just a little bit shady, but also kind of a goofy, you know, Midwestern character. And so there's a lot, I found as I've been talking to people around the country and actually in England about the book that, you know, this town is not unfamiliar to anyone in the country, but I thought it was pretty indicative of what you might find when you're driving around in northern Wisconsin.
You're a filmmaker, you're a podcaster, now novelist. What inspired you to write Ticktown as a book rather than a screenplay?
Well, I wanted to set out and write a novel. I'd never written a novel before, and I was very excited about trying to tackle the form. And in the last, say, 4 years, I've gotten really interested in pulp horror and the old paperbacks of the 70s and 80s. And so I was really focused on doing a novel, and I've thought about adapting it to a script. But a lot of the scripts I've written, I've produced myself, or some of the scripts I produced myself, some I haven't. But this would be outside my budget range to try and produce on a low budget. Giant marauding ticks probably would cost more than we usually spend on our movies. So it seemed like, but I was so excited when I found that, boy, when you write a novel, you don't have to worry about the budget and you don't have to worry about the effects and all that kind of stuff that I worry about when I sit down and write a screenplay. And so it was a very liberating experience to be able to, you know, basically anything that came to my imagination I could write, and it ended up being a lot of fun.
We're talking with filmmaker and writer Chris Miklos about his debut novel. It's called Ticktown. It's a throwback horror story about giant ticks invading a northern Wisconsin community. The book, as we talked about, is set in this fictional Tomahawk Hollow. And I think my favorite character is Emmeline Blacktier, the upstart young cub reporter who really follows her gut, isn't willing to hold back. She speaks out. Can you give us a little bit of a introduction to some of the main cast of characters that you created here?
Sure. Well, Emmeline is terrific. She's a lot of fun, and she kind of represents the kind of the fresh, not cynical member of the cast of Ticktown. And then her boss, Jackson Reed, who owns a small town newspaper that's going under. And early on, I had kind of envisioned, you know, some sort of metaphor for kind of the gobbling up of local media by, you know, big mutant corporations. And there still may be a little of that in there, but he's more cynical. He's trying to keep his paper alive, trying to keep a tradition alive. And then you mentioned the mayor, Silas Kankerby, who is kind of he's a hybrid of Mayor Vaughn from Jaws and Boss Hogg from the old Dukes of Hazzard show is how I like to think of him. And then there's a couple of cardboard cutouts. You know, these books from the 70s and 80s always had like these mysterious villains, and they were often Nazis. So I made a vaguely Nazi character who kind of comes into the community and is tied to the group that's responsible for the ticks. And I just, you know, I was just writing and kind of going gonzo with my ideas and with my approach to it. And so I kind of took an anything goes sort of thing and tried to throw in as many ingredients into the stew as I could. And I really liked how it tasted when it was all done.
One thing we picked up on is you have local journalists who are struggling to keep the small local newspaper afloat. And you've got – you make mention that the State Department of Natural Resources has funding cuts and isn't able to get to the scene that quickly on these farms. And then you've got this shuttered factory, Tomahawk Hollow Pesticides Plant. I also noticed that the bake sale for struggling farmers. So how does horror as a genre grapple with some real-world issues?
Horror, you know, if I put on my academic cap, you know, throughout the ages, going back to, you know, I'm wearing a Frankenstein t-shirt, going back to those early Universal movies to the big bug, you know, nuclear horror movies of the 50s and 60s that were also an inspiration for this. You know, they've always reflected people's anxieties, and they've always reflected, you know, the real world concerns that people were grappling with. And so there's some of that in there. I think I would be other than trying to, you know, create the metaphor for the newspaper, I would say I'd be lying if I said it was conscious. But I think when you're trying to create something that's going to affect people and stir emotions, you know, you have to, in some instances, tap into the things that actually do other than insects and creatures and monsters. And, you know, you start with the anxiety and then you can kind of blow it up into full-blown horror.
You've got a lot of blood and gore, and there are hundreds of people and townsfolk. What was it like to create so much bloodshed in a small town?
Well, the good news is that a lot of them were tourists, so they weren't their neighbors and friends, you know.
What was it, from Illinois or something? Yeah. I don't know.
It was Illinois. There was the Twin Cities.
You're right, right. Yeah.
But it's, you know, honestly, the gore and the, you know, which a lot of it is pretty cartoonish, you know. I wanted to make it big and broad and fun. But it was one of the things I struggled with, because I never – when you write a screenplay, you don't really write the gore very much. It's very matter-of-fact and straightforward. And so I wasn't sure that I would be particularly good at it. I think it's fun. I think – you know, I describe the book as kind of PG-13, and there isn't much harsh language, but there is a lot of blood. But I think it's I think it's more cartoonish, absurdist blood and gore, or at least I hope so.
What would it take to bring this to the big screen at Halloween?
At Halloween. Well, if anyone's out there, it will take a pretty good budget. I mean, actually, my earliest reviews of Tick Town have commented on the fact that it's written very cinematically. And I think that's just the nature of, how I am used to writing. You know, I think in terms of pictures, and I think in terms of action and that sort of thing. And so I think it's completely ready for big screen adaptation. But I think it would take a decent budget, though you can probably do it, and probably a producer like the giant spider invasions, Bill Rabane here in Wisconsin, who might, you know, maybe he'll see it and say, oh, this is something maybe for a good follow-up.
Chris, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great talking to you.
That was filmmaker and writer Chris Miklos. He talked to Kate Archer-Kent about his new horror novel. It's called Tick Town, which sees a fictional northern Wisconsin town invaded by a band of giant mutant ticks. The next stop on Chris's book tour is tomorrow at the bookstore in Appleton from 11 to 1. Here's a taste of a future segment here on Wisconsin Today. Producer Rochelle Wilson went out to record yesterday at a training for candy makers. We'll hear about that later this month on the show. And I'm hoping some samples show up here at the studio. When this airs, we'll be able to hear the unique sound of a bunch of people cutting up a big, big pan of toffee. A lot of crackling and laughing involved. Here it is. So sounds like fun. Do you make candy at home or professionally? We'd love to share your experiences. Tell us about it. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can text or call to get in touch at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Beatrice Lawrence and Rochelle Wilson. Our technical director is Sarah Hopeful. Tim Peterson is managing producer. Dean Knetter is our executive producer. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.